Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
There was really nothing that psychological science had contributed to understanding this behavior. And here I am, I'm a social psychologist. I'm supposed to understand thoughts, feelings, and behaviors and how those are influenced by the context, the situation, whether it's real or imagined. And I couldn't tell you in 2010 why people BS and what the consequences were. Those basic questions we didn't have answered. So I tackled it and I thought there's no better word for this behavior, which is distinct from lying. It's not lying. It's often confused for lying, but bullshitting is not lying. So the liar knows and cares about the truth, and the liar does not believe what it is they say. The bullshitter, on the other hand, doesn't care what the truth is. They're not paying any attention to it. In fact, what they say sometimes just by chance, by accident, is actually correct. But even they wouldn't know it because they're not paying any attention to truth, established knowledge, or genuine evidence.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. John, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure to have you here. So you have a book out called The Life-Changing Science of Detecting Bullshit, which I, as we said, you know, before we hit record, was probably one of my top five favorite books that I read this entire year, all of which we will get into. And I want to start with what I think is a very relevant question, given your background and the work that you do. And that is, what social group were you a part of in high school? And what impact did that end up having on what you ended up doing with your life and your career?
Wow, great. Yeah, I was actually in a small group, I guess, of what you might call nerdy jocks. I was in the nerdy jock group, where I did sports throughout the year, football, wrestling, track, and anything really. But academics still came first, and I was just interested in really everything. By the time I got to college, I really wasn't sure what I was going to do because I had so many interests. But yeah, if there's one sort of prototypical group that I guess I belonged to during my, you know, my elementary and high school years leading into college, it was that. And that also spilled into college. So I had quite an array of interesting friends too, because I had friends in both groups, the sports addicts and the people who just wanted to learn and or had interest in science and math and things like that, that really kept me busy. I was a busy kid and just read as much as I could. For some reason or another, I was attracted to books on Vietnam War when I was like 12 or 13 for some reason. I don't know. They kind of looked interesting. And I'd be reading letters home from Vietnam, you know, at 12 and 13. And sort of just went from there. And then reading sports books and then into into classics. F. Scott, anything F. Scott Fitzgerald, Great Gatsby, just captivated me. The writing is just beautiful, and so yeah, I was sort of an anomaly, because you really don't see many of those. And I try to recruit these types of students to my research lab, because I know they're out there, and you know, talent and creativity are, I think, they're spread throughout. Pretty evenly throughout, you know, the masses. And so I try not to pigeonhole students into one group, because I certainly wasn't in a single group. And I think that's, you know, it's led me to a career that fits me perfectly. So I'm at Wake Forest University, a social psychologist in Department of Psychology, and this was my number one, really, it was really my number one dream job, because there truly is a, I think there's a lot of lip service from one university to another that value both teaching and research. But I really think Wake Forest is one of the best compromises of that, and values both teaching and research equally. So I've always been sort of a hybrid and interested in just more than one thing. And that's, I think, has also kind of led my research career as well. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that really strikes me about you is that you seem to have had this very deep intellectual curiosity that really kind of sustained throughout your life from a very young age. You're an educator. Why do you think that isn't more common? Why do you think people don't ever discover that in high school? And a lot of us, you know, go all the way through college. And by the way, we share a love for Fitzgerald in common. That's why I actually became a writer. But the thing is, it didn't come full circle until 20 years later and getting fired from every job I ever had. And, you know, as an educator, what do you think happens to that? Like, I feel like I don't know many people like you in that sense, or I didn't when I was growing up.
Yeah. Well, if I could go back to those days, what I would have applied, if I had known then what I know now, I would have explored much more, doing maybe some job shadowing, internships, practicums, those types of things, or anybody that would take me in that I was interested in, even for a day or a week or whatever, you know, unpaid, just to explore the world of work. Even by the time I was in psychology, halfway through my undergraduate degree, I still didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. And I sort of foreclosed early on, well, I guess I'll be a social worker or a psychotherapist or a counselor or clinician of some type. I thought, well, that's what everybody does in psychology, but that's not true. There are positions everywhere in business, marketing, organizational, behavior, in law. I mean, it's all over the place. You know, statistical applications are useful everywhere, and these are things that psychology majors should and could take more advantage of if they actually saw what the world of work actually looked like. So that's what I do, is encourage students to seek those opportunities and see what it's like for 8 hours a day. You know, because honestly, I got quite bored in the clinical arena. Okay. I'm much more of a researcher. I like to surround myself with interesting people and interesting ideas and explore those even more through the science of psychology. And that wasn't even on the radar for me during my undergraduate years, because I didn't know that you could have a career in that. I would have done more of that, and I think that so many students also they tend to foreclose. If they do lean towards education, it's really based on the fact that they've sort of job shadowed, in a sense, through, you know, from kindergarten through 12th grade. You know, if they're in, you know, public or private school, that's the one profession that they have seen more than any. Is the teacher. And a lot of people are attracted to the profession, and when you ask them, so why did you become a teacher? Why did you become a high school teacher or whatever? You know, and a lot of them will tell you, unfortunately, well, you get the summers off and all of the holidays off, and it's pretty easy once you do it for a few years. And I'm thinking, like, gee, well, sounds like the last thing you want to do is teach. You know, you go straight towards all the times that you won't have to be. Now, certainly we have wonderful, you know, well-trained, passionate teachers today, but I don't think until we start paying teachers what they actually deserve, it's not going to be a profession that attracts the best and brightest. The same thing happened with nursing many years ago. Until people realize that the quality of nursing has a huge impact on the quality of healthcare delivery, until we realized that, we really weren't paying nurses what they deserved. And then as soon as we did, then healthcare improved right away. And then you also had people that weren't usually looking at the career, like men, for instance, being interested in nursing. I don't think we're going to see a change until we attract the best and brightest to be teachers. I think it's one of the most important jobs there really is, and it's, I think it's just not valued, you know, across the board as much as it should be. And we're passing on some of the best and brightest towards the profession simply because we're not valuing them enough.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
No, absolutely. I mean, it was funny that, you know, we're talking about that, because this morning I was writing, I was like, I think teachers are the most underpaid, underappreciated people in our society, because every one of us can probably point to a role that a teacher played in our life. I think, you know, teachers cause us to end up where we're at, and they don't get anywhere near the credit they deserve. But one other thing that I wonder about, you know, I always jokingly say that, you know, despite being a Berkeley undergrad and having an MBA, I'm a failed byproduct of the education system, because, you know, I had terrible history with jobs. And, you know, to your point, I think that one of the things that ends up happening is people pigeonhole themselves very early on with you know, collection of no data points. It's like, oh, you know, Indian parents basically say, go become a doctor. His kid has never set foot in the hospital or taken a science class, basically makes a decision about how they're going to spend the rest of their life. So one thing that I – and this is something I ask every single person who I talk to that's a college professor. You know, we're in kind of a mess as far as higher education goes for student outcomes. You know, people are riddled with debt. They're not starting families. They're not buying cars. They're not doing the things that actually move the economy forward, because they can't. So if you were tasked with redesigning the education system from the ground up to prepare us for the, you know, next 50 years, what would you do? Which I realize is a massive question.
Yeah, well, I've thought about this a lot, and I hope my answer is acceptable. I don't have any data to that speaks to the effectiveness of it, but I have a very strong hypothesis that if you improve and focus on basic communication skills, work that back into the curriculum. And while you do that, work back into the curriculum basic critical thinking skills. Okay, so when I was growing up, people asked for the time. They would interrupt. They would say, "Excuse me, sir, can I please have the time?" Today, when people, you know, if they don't have their smartphone on them, they're not checking their, or they don't have a watch on them, it's today, it's like, "Hey, what time is it?" And I'm like, "Are you talking to me?" You know, the basic communication skills are suffering. People are not learning this in their, you know, in their 12 or 13 years of elementary and secondary, you know, schooling. So critical thinking skills also has, I think, just gone out the window. Even before I was a senior in high school, I think it was my senior year in high school that my biology teacher asked us for a homework assignment to simply critique the book. So he had assigned a new textbook he hadn't used before, and we all sat there thinking, like, what in the world is he asking us to do? Critique the book. He even gave us examples. He said, "I'd like you to critique the paper, the pictures. How easy is it to understand, to find things?" You know, like, and we were all kind of clueless as to what he wanted. And I know most of us didn't actually give him what he wanted in this homework assignment. But that was the first time somebody asked me for my opinion in a class to give an informed opinion about something that wasn't just, you know, repeating back, you know, facts or things that I had learned in class. So basic critical thinking skills can take us so much further in life decisions, whether they're, you know, their academic career or relationship decisions. There was something you mentioned that about the messiness of basic, what way I thought about what you were saying is the messiness of data collection. we know from scores of cognitive psychology studies and social psychology studies that personal and even professional experience is the major driver of the inferences that people make about the world, how things work, and what's going to happen in the future. Okay, so that data collection method, though, is rather messy. Okay, it is what we get through our own personal experience oftentimes is random. It's it's unrepresentative. It's ambiguous. It's absolutely incomplete, considering the number of things that can happen and the types of data that you can actually collect. It's certainly inconsistent, and many times it's indirect. It's second or third hand, and oftentimes surprising or counterattitudinal, and not necessarily things we always want to count. So when you take the example of kind of figuring out, you know, a 17 or 18 year old trying to figure out, like, okay, what do I want to get into? What do I want to train myself and prepare myself for a career? It is extremely messy, and the data collection needs to be different. But critical thinking skills and basic communication skills, I think, will take students much further along optimal decision making, the path of optimal decision making, more so than all of the facts that they learn. There's a great study actually done. I'll never forget. It's rarely cited, but it's one that I've been sort of broadcasting throughout my career. And it was a study done by Marcia Baxter Magolda, and she studied at Miami University of Ohio. She did a longitudinal study with the same group of students for all 4 years of their undergraduate days, and she interviewed them their freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior year. And she asked them in the interviews some of the same questions each time. One of the questions she asked them was, where does knowledge come from? Or how do you define knowledge? And what she found was, in their freshman year, most students think, well, knowledge comes from the textbooks. It comes from the authorities. You know, it comes from my notes and the lectures. What she did, she found that by the time they were seniors, they were finally scratching the surface of realizing that knowledge is actively constructed, that they actually have a role in understanding and contributing to what we think of as established knowledge. Like in science, we know that, you know, probably half of what we think is true, certainly in psychology, maybe less so in some of the hard sciences. But certainly in psychology, I tell half of my students, I tell them half of what you are going to learn this semester is probably wrong, or that it's maybe partially correct under these circumstances, in these situations and contexts, it's correct. But when you change the context, the situation, it's actually wrong. Actually, the opposite is correct. And as we continue to find these factors that we call the moderators, or the factors that interact with what the variables that we already know, it becomes fascinatingly complex. And you're just not, I don't think you're ready for that if you don't have a good grounding in basic kind of critical thinking skills and asking, like, well, you know, how do I know this is true? You know, what kind of evidence actually led me to this conclusion? And until you start to scratch the surface, I think most students are just kind of shooting in the dark, and they will develop attitudes and opinions and beliefs, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be based on evidence, like genuine ideal evidence, as opposed to explanation, which is often confused for evidence.
Nah. Well, I think that makes a perfect segue into actually talking about the concepts in the book. And I think the thing that made me laugh was that you literally call your lab the Bullshit Studies Lab. How in the world did you arrive at a place where this is what you decided to make the focus of your life's work? And how in the world does university get away with calling, you know, a lab the Bullshit Studies Lab?
Yes. Well, I have a big favor already completed for me by Harry Frankfurt, the analytic philosopher, emeritus, professor emeritus from Princeton University, who had written a paper in 1986 called On Bullshit, and he defined it as a topic worthy of studying empirically. And he defined bullshit as just communicating with little to no regard for evidence, truth, established knowledge, and basically talking about things of which one knows little to nothing about. And, you know, by that definition, we could say, well, that's got to be one of the most pervasive social behaviors there are, right? But some people took him seriously. Some people thought it was, you know, cute and a joke, but he was dead serious. And when I encountered the paper, I thought, okay, no one's really going to take this seriously. I would love to look at when does it occur? Why does it occur? Under what circumstances can we attenuate this behavior? What are the consequences? Are there benefits to it? Are there drawbacks? You know, why do people do it so much? Because by that definition, gee, that's hard. It's hard not to bullshit, because to do the opposite, to be connected with genuine evidence, established knowledge and truth consistently and constantly is very, very difficult to do. And so the number of things that we're supposed to have opinions about, and we often feel obligated to have and share opinions about, is so large that it's just impossible to have a well-informed opinion about everything. You know, it's just, it would take forever. We wouldn't communicate much at all. You know, this podcast would be maybe 3 days instead of an hour, you know, because yeah. It would take us time to do the fact checking. It just, we wouldn't really function. So that work was sort of already done in 19 years later. A publisher took Harry Frankfurt's 20-page article and made it into a book, and it's one of the best-selling books in philosophy of all time. But it's that 20-page article. The pages are smaller and the margins are big and the font size is big. But I used this definition. I thought we need to know more about this. I was quite dismayed to find that when I started this work about 10 years ago, that there was really nothing that psychological science had contributed to understanding this behavior. And here I am, I'm a social psychologist. I'm supposed to understand, you know, thoughts, feelings, and behaviors and how those are influenced by the context, the situation, whether it's real or imagined. And I couldn't tell you in 2010 why people BS and what the consequences were. Those basic questions we didn't have answered. So I tackled it, and I thought there's no better word for this behavior, which is distinct from lying. It's not lying. It's often confused for lying, but bullshitting is not lying. So the liar knows and cares about the truth, and the liar does not believe what it is they say. The bullshitter, on the other hand, doesn't care what the truth is. They're not paying any attention to it. They don't care what the truth is. In fact, what they say sometimes, just by chance, by accident, is actually correct. But even they wouldn't know it because they're not paying any attention to truth, established knowledge, or genuine evidence. Okay, and the bullshitter often does believe what it is they say. Okay, so those are some big differences. Also, socially, we treat bullshitters with usually a kind of a social pass of acceptance. We think, oh, it's not a big deal. He's just BSing us, you know. But if your friend lies to you, usually that's followed up with quite a bit of anger and disdain, and your friend may have to tell 100 truths in the future to now gain for them to gain our trust and our sense of their honesty. So they're very different. The social consequences are very different. You could be fired for lying, right? But for bullshitting, it's like, oh,
You might even get promoted for being a good bullshit.
She's just trying to connect with people. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so this is why I think this book struck me so much, because we live in this sort of information age. You know, I interview people, and it's funny. I tell my, people who I teach to frequently to consider the possibility that what I'm telling them is bullshit because it might be in the context of their lives. And so that's one of the things that struck me so much about this book was that you really went deep. You opened the book by saying, although it's an unfortunate reality, many of our memories, beliefs, attitudes, and decisions are based on bullshit rather than evidence-based reasoning. This is why a deeper understanding of bullshit might be one of the most important intellectual and social issues that we face. And you say perhaps the greatest cost of bullshit is the fact that the time and effort required to undo its unwanted effects can be exponentially greater than time and effort needed to produce it. Bullshit can be produced in a matter of seconds, yet refuting it may take years. And then you go into a number of different things, which I think really struck me. So let's start with the personality test, because that was really fascinating. You said personality test alone can't explain behavior and performance. Two people who have the same personality type may vary greatly in their behaviors depending on the context. Yet think about how often, corporations, individuals use personality tests to make career decisions, to make hiring decisions, all that stuff. So like, why is this? And what's the negative consequence of this?
Well, the negative consequence would certainly be, I think, basing hiring decisions, promotion decisions, personnel decisions on these sort of, I want to call them, they're almost make-believe assumptions about the connections between personality and the fit for a particular type of task that one is going to do from 9 to 5 every day. So all of the data that we have on, Myers-Briggs types of personality tests, and there's a whole sort of army of these things that have been standardized. We know that these can be useful ways, using these types of tests can be useful ways to describe behavior. And oftentimes, they do show some sort of test-retest reliability in the sense that, if you've got one, Myers-Briggs code today, you might have the same code tomorrow. There are changes, but generally these can be decent. But you got to remember that these tests are all self-report. All right, so this is just a fancy way of describing how people tend to describe themselves. So if you respond to 100 questions on a personality test, and you say true for some and false for others, the test is going to be scored, and then we're going to feed you give you some feedback on basically in more eloquent language than most people can produce themselves is a description of what you said about yourself. It's an indirect. So a lot of times people are amazed by how it seems to tell us exactly what we already think about ourselves, but why not? Why wouldn't it? It's just like looking into a mirror and making it look a little more flowery, a little bit better. But the predictive validity, if we say, okay, well, this person took a big 5 personality test and they're highest on conscientiousness and agreeableness and openness. Okay. And we say, all right, now let's see. Let's try to make some connections between what kind of jobs they should be doing or what kind of work units they should be in and what we can ask them to do. And there are no data, conclusive data that show that, okay, if you match this personality profile with these various situations that they're going to succeed. Ipso facto, it's a strong correlation or a strong predictive value. It's just not there. So that's why I've argued you can take two people with the exact same, personality profiles, Myers-Briggs or whatever, and one could be completely happy and productive and in the best position possible. Another in a different situation. Maybe they're doing the same kind of job, but maybe the office is arranged differently, you know, or just some subtle things in the context, and they're completely miserable and they're unproductive because of it, you know. And so when you start to account for context and situation in these standardized personality measures, until you do that, you're not going to have really any data that will speak to this kind of personality situation context fit that is ideal for productivity, you know, creativity and bottom line performance. So many of them are marketed as though they do that, but I'm not aware of any measures that actually look at the person by situation interactions carefully enough to say that, okay, well, the person with this profile should be in this type of work atmosphere. It's just not there. So there's a lot of fluff, and it's built on this sense that, oh yes, it tells me exactly what I think of myself, you know, and people are just, they're sold by that because they just seem so amazed. And that's how these measures are usually marketed. It's like, okay, take the measure and then see what your feedback is. And then people are amazed, but they forget that all they did was just indirectly reported to the measurement what they already think about themselves. Why would they disagree? Why would you disagree with something that you've said about yourself?
Yeah.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home,
you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so then you go into what you say are the three good reasons why people tend to neglect the better voices of critical thinking and, you know, end up forking over good money for bullshit. One is a preference for bullshit over truth. The second is the idea of hearing is believing. And the third is the power of intuition. Let's go to the first two. I think the intuition one is really fascinating to me because intuition is such a big buzzword in the world of self-improvement. But let's get to that last. Let's talk about the first two.
Okay. So. The preference for bullshit, right? This can be a cognitive, a mental tendency, or it can be just completely motivational, right? So people, there's a strong tendency to adhere to what we call the confirmation bias. And it was almost wired to attend to that information, that from our messy data collection that is just based on our own personal experiences, rarely anything more than that, we attend to information that confirms our ideas about the world. And we like that. It makes us feel good. It makes us feel like we're correct, and completely ignore anything that disconfirms it. Sometimes when it's compelling data, we think more about it. And even if it does disconfirm our hypotheses, the more we think about it and the more information we get about that source of information, the more likely we are going to discredit it. We know from studies in social psychology done in the mid-70s that was a strong tendency. If you just give people some results of a study, they say there was this experimental study done, and actually it's counter to your beliefs about the connection between, I don't know, guns and violence, let's say. And you take someone who's pro-gun, and they will show a little bit of a shift towards the opposite attitude, towards the implications of the results. If you just tell them, this is the result, that in the 15 states that had this, they actually showed more violence with guns and the thing. Right now, just given the results, they tend to change their attitudes. But if you start to give them details, or they have time to look at the details on their own about that study, they tend to boomerang, rebound back to their initial attitude even more so, because they tend to discount it. They say, oh, the study was done in Texas, or, oh, it only had 15 states. That's not even half the states. And oh, they only used women as the participants or something. You know, I mean, like they'll find ways to discredit that information. So now we're back to just, you know, hyper-focusing on the initial hypothesis. And so sometimes by giving people facts, it just causes them to rebound or to double down even more strongly to their initial opinions and attitudes and beliefs. So there's a preference for that, because if there are two social motives that are strongest from the last, I guess, 70 years of social psychology research that we know, the two of the most frequent strongest motivations is, one is to be correct in our, you know, to feel justified in what we voice, what we publicize as our beliefs or in our attitudes, our opinions. And then the second one is to be consistent. Okay. To be correct and to be consistent. And those two motives can conflict with one another. And especially if you publicize your opinions, your beliefs, and your attitudes, it's very difficult for people to turn back and say, you know what, Srini, I was wrong about that. I didn't think that all through. I didn't have all of the data at the time. Now that I got more information, I realized that my initial, that's so hard for people to say.
Yeah.
You know, and to do. So
there are things I've written in my own books that I would go mm-hmm. back and revise. Based on, a couple more years of life. In the interest of time, so there's, I think the place that I really want to take this next, and it'll tie into, sort of intuition and, hearing is believing. Because I think for people mm-hmm. listening, this to me was one of the most important parts. It was this whole idea of people who are high propensity bullshitters, right? And you said they're high propensity bullshitters are remarkably easy to spot. They're the type of people who are often found mm-hmm. evangelizing and proselytizing their beliefs to anyone willing to listen. That's the entire yes. world of self-improvement. Mm-hmm. That's everybody on yeah. this podcast. That's every one of my guests, yeah. you, okay. me, and every guest that ever showed up. Now I wouldn't necessarily, criticize them for some of this stuff, but mm-hmm. you brought up a lot of things I think are, really big. The disregard for evidence, which I mm-hmm. think is rampant in, the world of self-improvement, on the internet. The other is complete reliance on anecdotal evidence and then pseudo-profound language. So I'd love for you to talk about this mm-hmm. in the context of sort of the world that people listening to this are living in, because they consume this type of information. They listen to people like you. They read books like mine. They, go to Tony Robbins seminars. I think of all the things that ever mm-hmm. struck me the most on the podcast, we had Rick Allen Ross, who's a cult deprogramming expert here, and he said nobody has done a properly, peer-reviewed research study on the effects of any of these self-improvement seminars to show that the long-term outcomes actually lead to improvements in people's lives. But I'd love for you to talk about this, because you criticized TED Talks, even though I know you gave one yourself. So let's mm-hmm. go into this, like expand on, the pseudo-profound language, anecdotal evidence, and all the things that, these are all things that literally I see on the internet all day long. And I probably yes. have done most yeah. of them myself.
Yes. Yeah, and honestly, when you have any hypothesis about how the world works, what the way people actually operate, and no matter what it is, it's rather easy to find at least a couple of good stories that support the idea. And people are attracted to stories. They're memorable. They tug at the heartstrings more. They get people to think more. They give them, it's also easier to talk about that, right? As opposed to the statistics of the masses, right? This is one of the reasons why, charitable organizations will run, major ads, and they'll tell you about this one child who's, starving and, some part of the world, and they give you all of the basic information about that one child, because they know people that'll move people more mentally and behaviorally, more so than the hundreds of thousands, millions of people who are starving, So you don't give people statistics. You don't give them, it's not good to give them the facts. It's better to give them a story. And it's just easy for people to find that. And the basic pattern that I've argued that the bullshit artist tend to use is they exploit that as much as possible, is they'll tell you about their best friend or their cousin or their neighbor who had, a reaction to, and they're sure that it was caused by a vaccine, like they're certain that, they've got this one piece of information. Now it drives everything. It colors everything that they see, and who cares about any of the data that is coming from, multiple independent lines of inquiry, among people who don't always agree. They rarely agree. scientists and medical professionals, they're the first people to tell each other that they're wrong, so to see that, to believe as though there's some big meeting that everyone's colluding and on the same page is just completely insane. It does not have any grounding in the way things actually work. But if you don't know how science and medicine, things like that actually work, it's easy to weight a couple of anecdotal pieces of, of data and for that to drive. The other thing the bullshitter artists tend to do, again, is focus on just unreliable types of data that, they get and they know other people get through personal experience. Because even if you don't have a friend that was injured by or had some kind of bad reaction to a vaccine, that you might know someone who knows someone who did that. Now you can use the story if it suits your purposes, you know.
Yeah.
And then people use, you know, they use proverbial cliches, you know, all of the time, as though if there's some sort of you know, some sort of wisdom hidden in this, you know, the idea of these popular cliches, like, you know, opposites attract, you know, versus, you know, birds of a feather flock together, right? I mean, like, well, usually when you focus on these proverbial cliches, you're going to find that there's another one that sort of disproves it, right? That it's equally correct. So, but that's not, but the bullshitter is not going to, make salient both of those. They're going to just focus on why one is correct. And here's the anecdotal data that support it, you know? But they also they tend to exaggerate their own area of expertise, you know, even if they don't have expertise, they can make people think I've got expertise in this. And what we do know is people who are often most confident about their competence and expertise are often the least competent. I mean, this is people have been writing about this Dunning-Kruger effect for over 20 years now. And it's just the basic idea that the cognitive skills, the mental skills that you need to be competent in an area are the same mental skills that you need to recognize your own and others' competence. So people will express this unabashed overconfidence often in some area that they really don't know anything about. And now if your audience knows as much or less, it's relatively easy to get away with, right? Because they're less likely to call you on BS. You know, so this is one of the reasons why I'm not going to bullshit an auto mechanic. I just don't know enough about how cars work. They're going to know right away
that
I'm bullshitting and I don't know what I'm talking about. And then if they don't lead on to that, now maybe they can take advantage. They know I don't know what I'm talking about. Now I might be taken advantage of. They might say, oh, this guy's a real sucker. He thinks he knows what he's talking about. Now I'll tell him that he needs some other thing that needs done that is maybe just window dressing stuff that he doesn't really need. So it's just when we make it easy for people to kind of get away with, they'll take advantage of it. And one of the first things I've learned in the earliest studies on this behavior was that people will do it in every situation except one, and that is that you don't make them feel obligated to share an opinion, and you don't make it easy to get away with. So if you can even demonstrate, well, I know some things about this topic, and I've got some expertise of my own, or I got some knowledge in this topic, you can signal to the bullshitter that, well, maybe they're not going to get away with bullshit because you probably know what you're talking about. And so that's one of the ways to expose ourselves like right away. But they don't ask, bullshit artists also don't, they're not going to ask and make salient the critical thinking skills questions that we need to be asking them when we can communicate with them directly. There's only three questions that you really need to ask. It's much simpler than people realize. But the first question that we should ask is what is the claim? You know, if we suspect someone of bullshit artistry, we should say, well, what exactly are you saying? You know, I hear you saying X. Is what you are saying X? And, you know, these other implications. Usually what will happen is bullshit artists will start to clean it up right away. They'll say, well, here's what I'm talking about. And, you know, and just make the claim as clear as possible, because we know that clarity is a major antidote to bullshit. So that you can, they'll do us a favor by exposing us less than by starting to clean up and say, well, no, I'm not actually saying that not actually saying that Bill Gates and George Soros actually paid people to, you know, invade the Capitol on January 6th. So what I'm thinking, what I really mean is that there are people who have a lot of money that are running this, that they might reframe it that way, right? So now you've already gone halfway. So then you work with that. And then once you get through what and clarify the claim, just ask how. How do you know that? How did you come to that conclusion? And even better sometimes, how would you know that claim or that idea is wrong? Okay. That's a much better question than why. If you ask why questions, usually what you're going to get is very heady, value-laden, very abstract reasons and explanation for things, but you won't get people to talk about evidence. You'll get them to talk about evidence if you ask them how. How do you know? And if you can get through those, ask, well, what have you considered, you know, this alternative? You know, all three of these questions, what, how, and have you considered an alternative? They help us diagnose the real motivation behind the bullshit artist. How connected are they to truth, genuine evidence, and established knowledge? And then we can make a better decision as to whether or not we're buying what they're saying.
Well, I think, you know, I love that you brought this up, because there's two pieces of this that I really wanted to ask you about. You talked about this whole idea of pseudo-profound language, and you say it's intentionally obscured through exaggerations, ambiguous references, insider jargon, buzzwords, and authoritative pretense that the speaker knows about things that no one else can possibly comprehend. And you say pseudo-profound bullshit contains vacuous and confusing words that obscure meaning and invite people to fill in the gaps with whatever they think the nonsense means. Well, Deepak, referring to Deepak Chopra, comes away sounding brilliant. And it's kind of funny that you brought him up of all people, because like there's a joke among Indians, it's like, this guy's not a medicine, he's not a medical practitioner, he's an online marketer. You know, the thing is, I don't think it's isolated to him. And I think that, you know, you also bring up a point about TED Talks. What do you want people to know who are listening to this about figures like Deepak Chopra and content like TED Talks?
I think the thing to know is that I guess the major thing to know is that a lot of it is bullshit. And second, that one of the reasons why we don't confront it is that people think, one, that they can usually detect that, and two, that it doesn't really have any negative effects. Okay. And we know that it has a lot of negative effects on learning, memory, decision making. What people believe to be true, what you believe to be true, has an incredible impact on judgments and decisions. And until people come to grips with that and accept that, one, they are susceptible to being duped by bullshit, and they're not as good at detecting it as they think they are. And again, two, to understand that there are great disadvantages to being influenced by bullshit. So, there are so many. I mean, even if you you go outside of New Age alternative medicine, outside of Deepak Chopra world, and also into business. I mean, we see a lot of business speak and corporate gibberish do this very same thing. There was a survey done, I think, over 15 years ago, and they had 10,000 entries, and they just asked people, what are the biggest bullshit words that you hear in the office? And some of the top 10 words were words like leverage, value add, bandwidth, touch base, incentivize, synergy, win-win, thoughtware, words like that that people use all of the time in best practice, you know, like, you know, I mean, just all kinds of words that again, yeah, you can fill in what they mean, and then they're useful, but people don't realize that how ambiguous they actually are. And until I think when they start to realize, like, okay, this isn't clear and it's not helping me in my judgment, in my decision as to what's actually going on, until they come to grips with that, they're going to continue to be exposed and to the unwanted effects of bullshit. Now, you mentioned TED Talks. I may also be one of the only TED Talk speakers, TEDx speakers to actually criticize TED Talks within my talk because there is a lot of BS, but it really mirrors the things that we're seeing for decades now in the latest groundbreaking ideas and leadership and success. I mean, there's so many titles, even in best-selling titles in business today that are completely contradictory. You know, there's a title on using love to lead. You know, well, there was at the same time there was a book called Business is Combat. there was literally, this was my favorite one. There was, it's called Out of the Box Strategies for Achieving Profits Today and Growth Tomorrow. At the same time, there was a book called Thinking Inside the Box, The 12 Timeless Rules for Managing Success. You know, so all of this stuff is really just a conglomeration of ideas that haven't actually been tested. So it's the marketplace of ideas that is just inundated with nothing more than ideas. They're not things that are actually empirically validated. And if it sounds intuitive, it might sound interesting and groundbreaking, profound, and it's going to have an influence. People are going to read books like In Search of Excellence, and make decisions and think, okay, well, yeah, what we really need to do is improve our hospitality. 7-Eleven did a study years ago after they found that their hospitality training really didn't have much of an effect on sales. They thought it should after reading In Search of Excellence, right? But they didn't actually test it. They tested it afterwards. People who enter convenience stores do not really care about the hospitality so much. They just want to get in and out, But if you focus on hospitality, then the lines get longer and people get grumpy because they're waiting in line longer than they should be, because now someone who's connecting with the employees in the store now is telling their life story, right? When you just want to pay for your Diet Coke and get fuel and get out. The experimental method and testing empirically ideas take us much, much further than what appears to be the new profound, groundbreaking ideas. There are oftentimes, they're just old ideas just waiting for someone to actually test and see if they actually have an impact on behavior. So, full of assumptions and cliche kind of, you can be the best and be the most productive. You can be anything that you want to be. I mean, that talk has been done so many times. Yeah. And it's just, but it can be uplifting. People like it and they watch it but there's a better way. I mean, optimal judgment and decision-making, I think takes people much, much further along the paths that they actually want to go than a lot of this untested bullshit that we see. Yeah. Kind of plastered everywhere.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the place I want to wrap up is with talking briefly about, the idea of personality traits, right? Because I think there are a lot of people who are like, oh, I'm way too smart to fall for this bullshit. But you go into the idea that, intelligence is not enough to protect you from bullshit. Common sense isn't enough. Like, and there are certain personality traits. Like, so basically all of us are susceptible. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that I've bought into a lot of bullshit at times. I mean, I joined a cult for 6 years thinking it would help me meet women.
Okay.
It was called the seduction community. Neil Strauss wrote this entire book about it, and we took a handful of outliers and we decided that, oh, those guys know what they're talking about. And those guys all turned out to be sociopaths.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. That's much more common. It just depends on how people define cults, right? I mean, like some people, even based on their political agenda and positions, often see people on the other side as though they belong to some sort of cult. you hear people talk about that. And people are much more susceptible to cult-like ideas than they realize, that especially in today's world where it's so easy to lock yourself into this echo chamber of life, whether it's real or it's digital, it's very easy to become more and more polarized in our beliefs, in opinions, because once you surround yourself with like-minded people, we've known this from actually the even mid-60s and from social psychological work, that you put people together with like-minded opinions and attitudes, they become more polarized. They become stronger in those beliefs, because now I heard something that, you know, an argument that you made that I didn't actually think about before. Now I think of it even more strongly, or you've debunked some other idea from the opposition, and now I feel I have another reason to have the belief. And it's really easy to kind of get, you know, trapped in that echo chamber and rabbit hole of beliefs if you're not looking at things from a critical, you know, critical thinking skills 101 standpoint, and being open to things that you don't necessarily agree with on the surface. I think people are usually quite reasonable, however, when they have, you know, good information. So I've argued that, you know, good, you know, better information does not always lead to better judgment and decision making, but better judgment and decision making almost always require better information. And once people are open to that, I think they tend to make better decisions. They're much more reasonable, and the inferences that they make from that information is much more rational. And there's tons of cognitive psychology work that supports that conclusion.
Wow. I feel like we could talk about this for like 5 hours. Like you said, this is a pretty deep rabbit hole. So I want to finish with my final question, which is how we finish all of our interviews, the unmistakable creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Something that makes someone unmistakable. How do you define unmistakable?
Well, if you write a book called Unmistakable, as I've said before, you have to define it. And to me, it's the thing that you can do that's so distinctive that nobody else could have done it but you.
Well, I'm not going to bullshit you on that. I'd have to think about that a little bit more and sort of the boundaries of that. So
that's fair, given the subject that we've talked about. You know what? You're the first guest to ever take a pass on the question. And given the subject matter, I have no problem with that. Like I said, I think this has been absolutely amazing. Yours was one of my favorite books that I've read this year. Where can people find out more about you, your work, the book, and everything that you're up to?
Well, I'm easy to find on Twitter at John V. Petro. And anytime, yeah, I mean, you find me easily at Wake Forest University Psychology on the web. Contact me there. My email's there if you have questions, and usually open to questions from anyone. So
amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.